Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and unlike most episodes where I'm joined by Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin, this week we have Alex Littlefield and Jim Stokes. And for those of you, you've seen Alex on previous episodes, but Jim has not been on previous episodes. So let me tell you who Jim is. So Jim is the Director of Nuclear Policy at NATO. And the reason Jim is on is we did an episode a few weeks back where we talked about this, the anniversary of NATO. And Jim and I know each other, and he had said he was on a NucleCast episode, actually, and he had listened to our episode here on the NIDS View, and he said, "Hey, I think you got a few things wrong about NATO." And I said, "Well, Jim, if we got it wrong, then that's all the more reason for you to come on an episode of the NIDS View, and let's talk about it, because, you know, we have varying opinions about NATO and its utility, and we've got a presidential election coming up, and there's fear in Europe that if Trump wins, NATO falls apart." And so it's just a great topic to discuss now because of the anniversary and because of the election and because of, you know, the Russians, and we've got France talking about they want to lead a new, you know, European nuclear initiative, and we've got countries, we've got new NATO members, we've got all sorts of things going on in NATO, which makes it prime for more than just one discussion. And so with that, of course, Jim, Alex, thanks for joining me on the NIDS View.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and thanks for reaching out and saying, "Hey guys, you got it wrong," because that's what makes, you know, these kind of roundtable discussions more interesting. If we all just sat around and said, "Oh, that's great, I agree. That would be boring and nobody'd listen. So Alex, of course, you know, we're going to always bring in the China angle because, you know, China is that, 400-pound gorilla that's always in the room and is always watching what the U.S. does in regards to Ukraine and elsewhere to try to draw lessons for Taiwan. And so thanks for being here, Alex.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Okay, Jim. So we got some things wrong in terms of particularly our criticism of NATO member allies. So tell us what we got wrong and how you see it, particularly sitting in your position at NATO.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to come on. And I'm not going to try to correct you guys, but I will. Let's try to correct the record a little bit and certainly talk about what we think is a good news story out here. But I think it's also important, you know, after I did the NucleCast a few months ago, been in this position for, I think, about 7 months now as, you know, previously an official with the U.S. Defense Department, now out here as an American working at NATO. But it's given me an opportunity to kind of talk to a number of different audiences across Europe about what we're doing with regard to NATO nuclear deterrence. But, of course, we also need to talk to our American audience as well to kind of explain how we look at nuclear deterrence out here at NATO, which the U.S., of course, is an integral part of that. But it's a bit of a different conversation compared to the way that you guys really explore nuclear deterrence issues back in the United States, where it's a lot of focus on, and rightly so, the modernization of the U.S. triad and everything we're doing there. A lot of investment in the nuclear security enterprise within the United States, dealing with that two-peer challenge between Russia and China, which is also something we need to kind of talk about more. But what we do here at Europe, it's a component of all that. But I think sometimes in the United States, we don't often have good visibility. So just to kind of quickly go back over the nuclear deterrence mission as we sort of focus on it here at NATO. So, you know, we have U.S. nuclear weapons that are forward deployed here within Europe. Have been here since, I think, approximately 1954 is when the atomic weapons first started to come over. And then through a number of different bilateral arrangements with a variety of different NATO allies, going back to the early stages of the Cold War, The U.S. has been able to position its weapons here within Europe, and then working with a number of allies, they've got different types of dual capable systems. Right now, just aircraft, fourth generation aircraft, that are able to employ those weapons if ever authorized to do so. So those dual capable aircraft, or DCA, are primarily what we focus on here, and also the U.S. nuclear weapons, the B-61s that are forward deployed here within Europe. So if you think sort of the scope of our mission set, what we discuss with now 31 allies within the nuclear planning group, it really kind of relates to that. And then what we have is an addition, if you will, from the United States and also the United Kingdom and France in kind of a different way at the strategic nuclear level that also contributes to the overall security of the alliance. But when I think about when I'm chairing my committee here at NATO, what we're talking about with the allies, it's primarily about those dual capable aircraft, the weapons that are here in Europe. What do we need to do as part of that core NATO nuclear mission to make sure that it's safe, secure, effective, and credible? Which also includes a lot of conventional support that we need from the allies, and then how that sort of relates to a much broader picture about what NATO is doing to strengthen its overall deterrence and defense posture on both the conventional side and the nuclear side in light of the current security environment. So to get back to the earlier podcast that you mentioned, so what I was, as I was listening to it and I was on a walk here in Brussels, I thought it was interesting, good to sort of recap the 75 years of NATO, because we just had its anniversary last month. That's also 75 years of NATO being a nuclear alliance, as I like to remind people, which is also a good thing. But given the context of what you're talking about, I didn't feel like we talked about nuclear deterrence enough, so I wanted a little bit more flavor of that. But there was a comment that was made about how essentially the U.S. is providing nuclear deterrence capabilities for NATO, the European allies, and also Canada. And there was, I think the comment was essentially it was almost like the allies are freeloading on it and
free riding,
really yeah. Free riding, yeah. So they didn't have any sort of direct involvement in that. And that's kind of the perception that I wanted to address a little bit in two ways, both at the political level and then also the military level. And of course, there's a financial aspect of that. So when I talked about that dual capable aircraft mission, you have a number of different allies that for many decades now have invested in aircraft, training of air crews, air bases and infrastructure to be able to support that mission set. And that's investments that are made nationally that don't come out of NATO's budget. So they buy those aircraft and maintain them. And again, they're dual capable, so they use them for conventional purposes, but they can also use them to support a NATO nuclear mission if ever authorized to do so. And then we also have other types of investments here at NATO that the financial burden is shared across now 31 allies, and where they each, you know, contribute their portion of that. But a lot of the investments have been made to increase the security around our air bases, nuclear surety upgrades. We're in the process of modernizing our NC3 systems. It's a significant amount of money. In the past, it's been in the hundreds of millions of euros. Going forward into the future, it's hundreds of millions to even billions of euros that are being invested in, again, that financial burden spread across the allies. So it perhaps pales in comparison to, you know, the U.S. modernization of the B-61s is about $8 billion. But when you compare that to the amount of GDP the allies have and their relative contributions, it's actually really significant, the amount of money that they're spending. Again, some of those allies, like the Netherlands and Belgium, directly contributing with the aircraft that they are buying. But then other allies that perhaps are not flying the mission directly, they are contributing their fair share of that burden, if you will. So that's a very welcome contribution. And then the other thing that's related to that is how the allies are investing more in conventional defense, which of course has a deterrent value as well. But as they make those investments, as they meet their 2% spending targets, as was talked about in the earlier podcast, overall, we're making more investments. And as we grow our capabilities, make the pool of forces bigger, grow force structure, we can then, you know, be able to use those conventional forces to support our nuclear mission if we need to. So as an example, I think the allies are investing in over 600 F-35s across the alliance, to exclude what the U.S. is also buying, which, of course, has a great benefit for the U.S. economy and job creation back in the United States, as it does here in Europe, as those F-35s are also being manufactured down in Italy and other places. But that's a necessary investment we need to really sort of take NATO air power into the fifth generation, and we're underway in that transition right now, so it's good from an overall defense perspective. But then we can pull from those conventional forces to be able to support our nuclear mission as well. So it's kind of an indirect contribution, if you will, but the Allies are spending more money. Admittedly, we haven't perhaps made those investments at the level that we should have in the past. And although heads of state and government have continued to say we need to meet that 2% spending target, we're not quite there yet, but it is getting better. I think overall, there's a number of ways that the Allies are making investments that supports NATO's nuclear deterrence that are additive to and complementary to what the United States is making.
Yeah, it's a good point. I wonder, as the Russians are looking at NATO, and then the second part of this is for you, Alex, is the Chinese are looking at what we in NATO were doing. Are the Russians saying, okay, well, now NATO member states are serious, and they're making the investments, they're building the forces, they're altering policy, they're doing the appropriate training and exercising, they're doing the things to show us that they're serious and that we won't be able to, let's say, roll through the Baltic states? And or are they not looking that way? Because I saw there was an article out today from, I forget where, but it said that Russia's economy grew by more in the past year than any of the other NATO member states. And so I wonder, how is Russia looking at it? And then how is China looking at, basically this? Because we're coming to a point where we have an east-west axis, authoritarians mostly in the east versus sort of Western democracies. And how do you guys think that's sort of shaping up?
Yeah, I have a question and first a confession. I hadn't listened to the 75th anniversary of NATO podcast, but it got me thinking, I guess it was roughly around the 50-year mark that NATO had sort of run its course. The Cold War was pretty much won. And now the question was, is it now time for NATO to disband? And there wasn't really, at least from where I sat, I didn't see any compelling reason for it to continue. And I remember General Shali Khashoggi, when he was still a general before he was working for I think he was Secretary of Defense under Clinton, he spoke to us and said, why NATO needed to continue to exist. And I was thinking, raise my little hand and say, are you sure about that? The Europeans can do this on their own without assistance from the Americans. But now, things like Kosovo came up and other things were these little contingencies where NATO found a role. But now, thanks to Putin, they've really brought NATO back with a roar because it's bigger than it was even back in the heyday of the Cold War, because now there's all these, who could have thought Finland or Sweden or any of these countries would, ever join NATO? That'd be impossible, and now here they are. So NATO is actually bigger than it's ever been. And at the same time, the Warsaw Pact is smaller than it's ever been, for example, because it doesn't exist, for one thing. And then you take a country like Germany. Well, it used to be like East Germany was on the one side and then West on the other. But now, hey, it's all now Germany all on the West side. It's all the Federal Republic of Germany. No more German Democratic Republic. So in one sense, things are looking really good for NATO. It's big. It's strong. Those people who used to be part of the Warsaw Pact are now actually aligned with us, right? Poland, there's no way they're going to side with the Russians. There's no way Hungary or any of those. Well, Hungary's a little bit different, but in general, these countries are sort of on the good guys' team. But then there's still a lot of other issues. Just for example, Jim mentioned, Russia's economy is going stronger than the Europeans, because back in the Cold War, Russia had that planned economy, and it was things weren't good, and Europe was strong and rich, and now maybe it's not looking quite as that contrast of who's rich, who's poor, the capitalist versus the communist. That's not quite as clear maybe as it used to be. And then you mentioned here this access, because now, whereas China was really not involved and wasn't really a big player, but now China's a very big player. And how do they perceive this, and how do they see their role now with Europe and Russia, and actually China has influence in Europe too, like maybe with places like Hungary. So it's a big question, how does China view this? And I mean, the short of it is they're benefiting from the conflict going on right now. North Korea benefits, Iran benefits, China benefits. You know, China's getting cheap oil, cheap gas from Russia. It's getting enriched uranium from Russia. The North Koreans are selling munitions to the Russians. The Iranians are selling drones to the Russians. So a lot of people are benefiting from the conflict. On the access side of things, I'd say they're benefiting much more than anyone on the allied side. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions and things to weigh in the balance, the scale of where does NATO stand and how is this all playing out? Who's benefiting and who looks to be in a better position?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, you know, I wasn't working NATO back in the 90s when I was still in college at that point. And, you know, it's a different perspective being out here in 2024. So it kind of missed over a lot of that history in the post-Cold War period and in the debate about, you know, whether NATO should expand. But I could tell you from being here at headquarters now, last year when Finland joined the alliance and then when Sweden joined this year, and talking to people from a number of different countries that have joined in the past 20 years, 25 years, we've had a lot of celebrations of some of those anniversaries this year. Just a couple weeks ago, being in Warsaw and talking to people in Poland about this, I mean, they're very happy that they're able to join NATO, and you know, if they also have an opportunity to join the EU as well, because they want to integrate that way. They want to integrate towards the West. I think we've seen greater integration off Europe, across Europe, and it's to benefit a lot of different people. They are seeking democracy. They want capitalism. They want to have security and stability, and truly the absence of war. And so I really don't think that there's any other choice. I don't think it was a bad decision on anyone's part to expand NATO further eastward. And it's not that we were trying to do that vis-a-vis Russia. It's because we had sovereign nations making decisions about their future security and prosperity. And, you know, and related to our two newest allies, this was fundamental to the internal discussions and debates that they had, both within, you know, their capitals and then with their publics. After the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 by Russia, and how in Helsinki and in Stockholm, they made a fundamental reorientation of their security policy and decided that they want to join NATO. Now, they had been partners with NATO for many years or decades preceding to that, so there was already a closeness, a proximity. But I know when I was here at headquarters when we had the flag-raising ceremony for Sweden, which was just the beginning of April, and listening to the Swedish Prime Minister talk about how Sweden had moved away from 200 years of not being part of a military alliance and then deciding to join NATO, and Finland approximately a year earlier, same sort of thought process. And part of that is because NATO is a nuclear alliance, and that was the one thing that Finland and Sweden are very strong, capable allies. They have highly capable militaries. They could stand on their own, but they joined NATO in part because you fall underneath the extended deterrence commitment of the United States fully through Article 5, and then also the way that we share the political and military responsibilities for nuclear deterrence here at NATO. And both of those allies coming in, not having a history of dealing with nuclear deterrence matters, they primarily have looked at nuclear weapons through perhaps an arms control or disarmament lens, but they've been very sort of active and engaged in trying to understand these issues, contribute to the internal debate that we have within the alliance, which is very healthy that we have 31 allies in the nuclear planning group that discuss these issues. And in light of the current security environment, because again, we're not doing this out of the blue, we're doing this in reaction to the current security environment, how we need to continue to adapt our policies and plans and posture and modernize our capabilities, a lot of which began many years ago, even before the full-scale invasion, but after 2014 and Crimea was invaded. And we will continue to look at how we need to adapt moving forward as well. And it's not in reaction to any specific thing that's being done, but overall, you know, we recognize that the Euro-Atlantic area is not at peace right now, due largely to Russia's aggression in Ukraine, but also individual things that are done against NATO allies and things that are undermining the security and stability here in Europe. Now, pivoting to China, that's also something that I think is on the minds of the allies here. As Americans coming from the Pentagon and the Defense Department, we sometimes tend to compartmentalize or regionalize things. And of course, when we talk about the United States and its allies and partners, we sort of think from the United States moving out. Here at NATO, it's a different perspective because we have NATO allies at 32, and then we have a variety of different NATO partners around the world, many of whom are also U.S. allies and in the Indo-Pacific region. And what I've observed in the last couple of years is a really interesting dialogue that we have with especially our Indo-Pacific partners, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, as in that region, and also as allies of the United States and sort of underneath the U.S. extended deterrence commitment, and as they are looking at some of the security challenges in their region, both from China and also on the Korean Peninsula. And then we have dialogues here at NATO headquarters where those partners come in. They talk about the issues they see in their region. We're talking about the security challenges we have here within Europe, but there's linkages across these. And we're looking at how we can have ways to bolster our overall deterrence and defense posture in both regions, how that overall sort of supports, you know, global security, kind of prevents conflict from breaking out anywhere, which would have global repercussions. It's not contained to a specific region. And then also a good understanding of some of those security challenges, which, you know, they do emanate from Russia and from China and North Korea and Iran. But as Alex mentioned, through the alignment and the relationships we've seen between those four nations in particular, it has cross-regional effects. And with three of them, they already own nuclear weapons. And so authoritarian states with nuclear weapons, and especially what the Russians are doing, you know, they've invaded and occupied Ukraine, and then they've been very coercive in their nuclear rhetoric and signaling and some of their potential posture changes. And that's very threatening. And it's not just to allies that are here in Europe. It's not just the United States, it's to other states around the world. So we seek to uphold the rules-based international order. We see other states that are seeking to undermine it, disrupt it, try to move it in a different direction. And so that's bringing together like-minded democracies that are looking at ways that we can counter that. This is good because it sort of supports cross-domain or cross-regional deterrence, if you will, where, you know, I would hope that, you know, potential adversaries would take stock of the fact of after the Russians had the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, how did the world react to this? You know, it wasn't necessarily common across the board, but it wasn't just localized here in Europe. You had a number of other states that are also providing different types of support, financial or material, to Ukraine. And that could be the case in other conflicts as well. We've seen that historically. You look back to the Korean War, what are the nations that were part of the United Nations Command? How did they contribute to that effort? So we should never, you know, and I don't think that we would do this, but I don't think anyone should think about conflict just being binary between two states. We never know what the sovereign decisions will be made by different countries when they might see it in their interests to join one side and provide capabilities or some other way of being able to support that. I think it's an important thing for us to kind of continue to consider as we're thinking about our overall deterrence and defense posture.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I wonder, from an American perspective, you know, we're looking globally and we're looking at, you know, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and then you have, and there's this sort of authoritarian axis that I think the war in Ukraine is actually solidifying. You know, there was much hope that the war in Ukraine would break the Russian army. And that's one of the things the U.S. could accomplish is break the Russian army by supporting the Ukrainians to allow them to do that. And it doesn't seem to be working that way. The Russians are sort of doing what the Russians have historically done, where they grind opponents into slow but eventual victory. And then they're solidifying ties with the Chinese, the North Koreans, and they have the materials they need. And then you have countries like Brazil that are sort of, they're not quite authoritarian, but they don't like the U.S. either. And, you know, India's the, you know, BRICS country that's sort of playing a middle ground. And I wonder, is there a perception in Europe that almost akin to the Cold War, where you sort of, you had, you know, the non-aligned movement, but then you had the East and the West. Is Europe saying, hey, wait a second, I think we've seen this before, and we're sort of moving into a period where it's not the same countries that are aligned with each other, and it's not the same ideology necessarily, but we're seeing these sort of two blocks forming? Or is that, you know, more of an American perspective?
No, I think that that largely tracks with how a number of countries see that. I mean, it does seem like that divide we had in the middle of Europe during the Cold War has effectively shifted east, and also north as well, where, especially with the accession of Finland to the alliance. Like, our geography at NATO has fundamentally changed, and, you know, how large the alliance is, almost a billion people underneath our protection now. But I do think there is an element of sort of the, I wouldn't call it an East-West divide, but perhaps a democratic versus authoritarian divide. So there's some similarity there. And then there are a number of nations that it does seem like they're trying to sort this out. I mean, I think in general, there's still many countries around the world that they don't want to see war, and they're satisfied that they don't have war in their region. There's also, you know, especially within the disarmament community, there's a number of different nations that are very happy that they're in nuclear weapons free zones. They would love to see more disarmament. They're worried about the trends that they're seeing from Russia and China, but, you know, they also sort of castigate some of the other nuclear powers as well in terms of, hey, you guys aren't doing enough to actually disarm and get rid of your nuclear weapons. And I think this is what's providing a lot of fuel for the TPNW, the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, and why there's another number of countries that are interested in that. And, you know, I think there's a lot of nations that are sort of looking at both sides. You mean, they may be security partners with the United States, but they're also looking at being economic partners with China, and it's difficult. I think a lot of countries don't really want to pick sides at this point in time, because it's probably not in their interest. And even here in Europe, I mean, China, as with the United States, it's a huge trading partner. There's a big economic impact here, a lot of integration. So, you know, we don't see China as a threat here at NATO. It is a challenge and something that we need to continue to look at how we manage that compared to the way that we see Russia right now. But, you know, I think one thing that is of concern to all allies within the alliance is, you know, the potential for conflict in the Indo-Pacific region. And, you know, that could be, you know, something that involves the United States and China, but it could also be something in the Korean Peninsula. We're worried about the ripple effects that would happen around the globe, right, from an economic standpoint, from a global security standpoint. Obviously, from my perspective, there's, you know, looking at
things... Can NATO actually ever say it's not our problem? Because and maybe Alex, both of you guys, because if let's suppose hypothetically that there is a China conflict and China attacks the United States, and then the United States, you know, asks for an Article 5 declaration, there's just no way Europe sort of gets to stay out of it. And we sort of saw this with the, you know, the war in Afghanistan, in that, you know, eventually we're sort of all of our boats either, you know, float together or sink together. And I'm not sure how we do that. And then I've often wondered, like, at what point does, you know, I talk to the South Koreans a lot, and the South Koreans look at themselves and their world and they say, oh, we're the Israelis. You know, we're the Israelis. We're, you know, a small country around a lot of hostile powers, and, you know, the Israelis have nuclear weapons. Maybe we need them as well. So how do you guys, I mean, Alex, Jim, what do you guys think?
Jim, there was something you said earlier about it's not an East-West, but it's a authoritarian versus non-authoritarian, got me to thinking. It's kind of both, because the bulk, if you look at the bulk of this axis, they're all east of the NATO countries, right? It's Russia, Iran, China, North Korea. But again, at the same time, it's not as simple as that either, because we have allies like South Korea, Japan, which are also firmly planted in the east. So it's kind of like maybe a west-east thing. But going into World War I, World War II, And you talked about, Adam, how the alignments sort of change, and it is, right? Because World War II, the Germans were fighting it in Europe, and then the Japanese in the Pacific, and the Japanese and the Germans were kind of, you know, working together to take on the Americans and the British and all their allies. So now, instead of it being Japan, now it's kind of China and Russia, instead of it being Japan and Germany. So it's kind of interesting how the players have sort of changed, but it's still, the balance is still kind of looking something like what we saw in World War II. It's just slightly different. The name tags have been changed on the t-shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, the part of the debate here is, you know, would NATO have a role in the Indo-Pacific region? And, you know, our, you know, SACUR's area of responsibility, it doesn't extend out there. So from a military perspective, it's sort of, it's beyond us. But, you know, you bring up a good point, Adam. I mean, politically, we've only had the Allies invoke Article 5 once in the history of NATO. That was right after 9/11. And so that would be a decision point in the future. You know, what would be the political commitment? And then each nation would sort of figure out how it might support the United States if there was a conflict. Just like, you know, we have individual nations to figure out how they're supporting Ukraine or how they're handling the situation in the Middle East right now. So you just don't know. And I think that overall
it's a tough one.
It strengthens deterrence, though, because you just don't know how they're going to do that. I know when I worked at the Pacific Command, which seems like it was 100 years ago, a lot earlier in my career, but I remember talking to the Australians, and the Australians are always very clear to the Americans. They've been with us, the United States, in every conflict since, I think, at least World War One, if not earlier than that. And so, you know, and it hasn't been just localized to, you know, conflicts in the Asia Pacific region. I mean, the Australians were with us in World War One and World War Two, and committed forces to Europe. So you just don't know how that's going to play out. Even back in you know, the early stages of Operation Enduring Freedom, again, when I was working with the South Koreans in, and they had forces that were contributed to Afghanistan and later on to Iraq. So each nation is going to decide how it wants to come down on the issue and which side to support. And I think overall that's good. So that's why we need to have these political military dialogues about these issues, make sure we're all on the same page to the extent we can. And I think that has a deterrence effect, right? If you're trying to affect the thinking and the calculus of a potential adversary, don't go there. Otherwise, you don't know what might happen. That helps that, you know, not only within a formal alliance structure like at NATO, but how we've got these allies and partners across the world that are thinking about these things from a common perspective.
Yeah, unfortunately we're about out of time, but let me ask one more sort of question for you both. And you know, this was part of the big discussion in our 75th anniversary episode, and that was sort of the 2% commitment and which countries are doing that and which countries are not, and just this discussion of, you know, for countries that are really feeling, you know, the Poles are exceeding it, you know, pretty significantly. The Greeks do it, but they do it because of the Turks, not because of the Russians. And, you know, the Baltic states are spending more, but, you know, the sort of that Western part of the alliances, they don't feel the threat quite the same, you know, whether you're Portugal or Spain or and unfortunately, we didn't even get a chance to talk about Euro nukes and the French efforts. But just in terms of spending, how do you see that? Is it problematic, or is it just it's not a big deal because it works itself all out?
I think it is important, but it's not the only important part of that. So spending is essentially it's your spend plan, right? So it's a percentage of GDP to be spent on defense, and then also a subset of that needs to be spent on procurement or sort of capital expenditures. We're seeing good trends right now, so we're not where we need to be. Not all of them are meeting that 2% spending target, which is we see that as the floor, not the ceiling. So spending more is certainly encouraged. Publicly available information, I think, will be forthcoming from NATO later on towards the summit in Washington in July. But there is going to be an uptick in the number of allies that are there. You know, Adam, you mentioned Poland. Poland actually spends more than any other ally when you look at the cost share. The United States is factored a little differently. But Poland's up, I think, either at or over 4% of GDP. Yeah. So great. That's where we need them to be. And this is why NATO really is kind of a good news story for the United States. a comparison to the bilateral alliance structure that the U.S. has with its Asia-Pacific partners, here at NATO, you sort of have this collective buying power, right? So we have this whole apparatus within the organization where we can come together at 32 allies and make these decisions and then figure out how to make those investments, grow those capabilities, and then align them to all the planning that General Crivoli, SACEUR, and SHAPE have been doing, and so, you know, how you can fit all these things together, which really helps the United States, because if there's something going on elsewhere around the world, and we saw this even when conflict, you know, sort of arose in the Middle East in the fall of last year, it can take away focus and attention and resources. If the U.S. needs to tackle something elsewhere around the world, what we need to do here at NATO is ensure that we're developing those capabilities so we still have a strong deterrence and defense posture vis-a-vis Russia or any other challenge that may arise here, which then helps the U.S. if it has to make commitments elsewhere around the world or support its other allies. And so it's a good news story that we're on. We're not where we need to be. Spending the money is good, but as you know, if you've worked in the Defense Department, what really matters is fielded capability. So we need to see forces in the field with the munitions at the right levels, training exercises, the whole bit, and then aligned to the plans and interoperable with each other. So we're on the right path. We're not there yet, but it is a good place, and it's getting much better over time.
Okay, so we're out of time, but Alex, I want to ask one final question from you. So you're the Chinese. You stay in, you know, up to date on Chinese thinking. You read their papers, and tell me, what are the Chinese thinking about what's going on in Europe right now?
It's generally good news, because the number one foe would be the United States, and we're distracted. And we're distracted there, we're distracted in the Middle East, and at the same time, we need to be preparing for a contingency in Taiwan. So we're spreading ourselves thin, and every moment we are thinking about NATO and investing in NATO, which is fine and necessary, but that's then one less thing we can do in China. It's going to be, you know, it's about supply chains. Russia's still in the game because, you know, they managed to find a source for their drones. They managed to find source for munitions. They managed to find a source to sell their oil to. So as long as they can keep those supply chains running, and our supply chains are struggling to chug along to supply what's going on in the Middle East or in Ukraine, then, you know, that's less we have available for Taiwan. So it's good news. I mean, as from the perspective of Chinese, I'm happy. I like this. It's win-win for me. You know, favorite Chinese expression, win-win. It's a win-win situation for China.
Yeah. Okay, well, great discussion. You know, we could have sat here for another hour or two and just discussed so many more issues, because, you know, it's NATO and Europe might have been quiet for a while, but that period is now gone. It's an exciting place to be right now. And so, well, I'm sure we'll talk about it again soon. Of course, Alex, Jim, thanks for joining us and having this great discussion on the NITS View. Thanks for being here.
Yep, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. And always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NITS View. This show is produced under the NITS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.